Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. Well, perhaps Graham Fife was correct, and after taking second in the individual time trial this past week, Chris Froome just might be the overall winner of this year's Tour de France. But there's still a lot of racing to go, and it's been both an interesting and exciting tour, although a little bit weird. So I'm wondering what's up with somebody throwing urine on world champion Mark Cavendish during stage 11. You know, what the hell? That goes right to the what is wrong with people category, but then I guess that list just seems to keep growing. Meanwhile, there's little else in this show that has to do with pro racing or the Tour de France Peloton. Nope. In fact, it's pretty far from it. This week, we're talking mountain biking, walking, and Ragbri. Back in 1999, Brian and I rode Ragbri. I think every year, riders say that their Ragbri was the hottest, hardest, and craziest. So when Greg Borzo's new book, Ragbri, America's Favorite Bicycle Ride, arrived at my door, I immediately went to the chapter about 1999 to see if our claims to the hottest and most difficult ride were true. And they were. Here's a short excerpt about the 99 ride. Quote, temperatures hit the high 90s the first 5 days and 101 in Decorah the following day. High humidity drove the heat index to 120 degrees, even as late as 10 p.m., making sleep all but impossible. So vindicated or not, the event is truly amazing in the most literal sense of the word. Greg Borzo will be with me in a few minutes to tell us about the book, the ride, and the future of Ragbri, the Mardi Gras on wheels. My second guest is Scott Bricker. Now, it was hard for me to believe that there are actually two Scott Brickers in the advocacy bicycle pedestrian world, but there are. Tonight, Scott Bricker is the executive director of America Walks. It's a national nonprofit organization whose mission is to make America a great place to walk. And because walking is intimately associated with cycling on the level of advocacy and sustainability, and Scott comes from a background of bicycle advocacy, I thought his perspective on how communities can build support for active transportation issues would be most enlightening. The other Scott Bricker, by the way, is the executive director of Bike Pittsburgh on the other end of the country. So after a break, we're going to head out to Bend, Oregon to talk with someone who is a survivor. Really, Lindsay Voorhees was a contestant on the show Survivor Africa 2001, and she says it changed her life. Now Lindsay's giving it all back by changing the lives of women all over the U.S. and teaching mountain bike skills clinics. Lindsay grew up in Portland, Oregon, started racing cross-country in 1994. Today, she says that she wants to change women's lives with two wheels and some dirt. Along with her mountain biking husband, Kurt, Lindsay helps run the All Ride Tour, which travels the country promoting some of the top brands in mountain biking product. So settle back, pop the top on your favorite beverage. We're going to head on over to Chicago first to talk with author Greg Borzo about one of America's favorite summer events, Ragbri. Greg, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Well, hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it is my pleasure because I'm a Ragbri fan. So what prompted you to write Ragbri, America's Favorite Bicycle Ride, for what's going to be evidently the 41st year, huh?
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah.
I wrote the book because I grew up in Des Moines. And the first year I remember the ride. I was a taxi driver for the Rouen Cab Company, and ever since that first year, I was very interested in doing the ride, and I never got around to it until, 2009 or so. And the more I heard about it, the more friends I had who did it, and the more I learned about it from doing it myself. Finally, I said, "Let's do a book." And I was surprised there's no other book that tells the whole comprehensive story. So I thought 40 years would be a good time to look at it.
Tell us a little bit about the origins of the event.
Well, like the Tour de France, it was started by a newspaper. And those are the two most successful newspaper promotions in the history of the world, the Tour de France and Ragbri. So two reporters for the Des Moines Register decided to bike across the state, and they wanted to get the newspaper to pay for their hotels and food along the way. So they proposed the idea, and the Register said, okay. And as an afterthought, the Register said, well, why don't you invite readers along? And so they put a little notice in the paper saying that John Karas and Donald Call were going to ride across the state on their bikes, and anyone would be welcome to join them. Well, 200 people showed up the first year, and then the second year, whatever, 2,000, and it grew from there.
And it's huge. It is huge. Just a mammoth.
It's huge, even though it started as a lark.
And that's just when I spoke with Graham Fife, who just wrote a book about the 100 years of the Tour de France. He said the same thing, you know, that it started as sort of this promotion to try and get his newspaper more readers and more purchasers. And then all of a sudden it grew to this mammoth event, which, of course, is going on right now. So in your preface, you talk about the challenge of Ragbri with, quote, its own version of a 4-H club. I thought that was really cool. So what are the Ragbri 4-H's?
Well, that's the bad news about Ragbri. The 4-H's stands for heat, hills, humidity, and headwinds. You know, we live in a society where we're always in air conditioning, and we are not challenged physically to, you know, chop wood or plow fields. So it's actually wonderful. That's actually part of the good thing of Ragbri, is it is intense and challenging and hot and humid. And you get out there in nature and you experience things differently than we usually do in our you might say, couch potato society.
You think? Yeah, I would agree with that. You know what, and I don't know if people realize this, Iowa is a beautiful state. It is not what people think. People think it's flat and it's boring. It is anything but flat and boring.
That is very interesting you say that, you know, because I grew up again in Des Moines, and I always thought I was boring and flat and repetitive, the same old cornfields. But then I went to Grinnell College, and there were tons of students from New York, California, around the country, and they all said, wow, this state is beautiful.
Exactly.
And that's what made me start looking at Iowa a little differently myself. But then biking it, you really see it even more than you could from the interstate. You see it up close. It is beautiful. It's got some very nice rolling hills and some great water features and rivers and lakes and whatnot, wooded areas.
It's got lots of animals.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially piggies. Yeah. So deconstruct it a little bit, and then let's talk about the fun stuff. Who is the ride director, and how many staff members are there that, you know, manage this enormous undertaking?
Well, the ride director is T.J. Kutzkowitz. Everybody just calls him TJ.
I can see why. Yeah.
Yes, right. And he's been there about 12, 13 years now, doing a great job organizing the event with a staff of only 3.5 full-time people. So the answer to your question really in one word is volunteers. It's really volunteers that make this work. And they step forward to run committees, to organize events, to raise money. It's just an incredibly huge volunteer event, which is another unique thing about this, something on this scale being really pushed and moved forward by volunteers is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and volunteers almost always have as much fun as the participants. I know that. You know, good volunteers just have a ball doing these kinds of events. Well, it's a west-to-east event always, right? From one river to the other. What is it, the Missouri to the Mississippi?
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that, the M to M. And I remember that every single day you'd say, okay, where's that next water tower? That's how you knew you were coming up on the next town.
Right. And it's a wonderful state for such a ride because the next town is usually only about 8-10 miles away.
Right.
I was dotted with all these small towns, and they make great pass-through towns, and then every 80 miles or so, you have an overnight town, which would be a bigger town. And then they will host this horde of 15,000, 20,000 people who descend on them for one night.
And that's what I want to talk about next. So I know that, I don't know if you were the first ride, if Ragbri was the first ride or not, but basically those who are quote unquote legitimate riders go through a lottery process. I think it's in February to be accepted into the ride and get the Ragbri wristband, which entitles them to some stuff. But the fact is that that's not only who rides.
True. So you've got 8,500 people who get a wristband to ride the whole week each year.
Okay.
And then day by day, there's another 1,500 wristbands that are given out just for a one-day ride.
Okay.
So if you have 10,000 official riders, then the others who kind of tag along, who just come along for all or part of the ride, are called bandits or renegades, and they actually add to the spirit. It'd be great if, you know, they all paid their fee and participated, but many years, as you say, it's a lottery, and the ride cannot accommodate any more people officially. So some of these bandits come along because they really want to ride, and they have no choice other than just to come along without their wristband, without having paid. But their numbers swell depending on the town for that particular day. For example, this year is coming to Des Moines. Well, you know, coming into and going out of Des Moines, there's going to be
a gazillion people.
10,000 people that are
sure.
just going to jump on a bike and ride along for a day just for the fun of it. And they're open public roads. No one can say no.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about the people who actually come on this ride. Because I can remember seeing everything from 20-inch banana bikes to full-blown, you know, people with kits and carbon fiber bikes and, you know, fancy helmets and shoes and everything else. Who does Ragbri? Do they do any demographic studying of who's actually on the ride?
They do, and over the years, it's changed a bit. The ride, as it ages, the riders are aging also. So the average age today is about 44 years old, and it's about 60% men. Over 50% come from out of Iowa. So we do attract people from every state. Pretty much every year now, people from every state participate. And so it's a whole variety of people. Sometimes families, sometimes three generations are riding together. Sometimes you just have a group of serious cyclists. Sometimes you just have a group of serious partiers.
Yes, you do.
Make up the different teams. But what's wonderful is to see the variety of vehicles these people are biking on. As you say, a banana seat bike to a high wheeler, one of the old, penny farthing bikes with a huge front wheel. I've seen unicycles. I've seen the new elliptical bikes where it looks like you're skiing, but you're actually riding a bike.
Wow.
I've seen a lot more recumbents, and there's even tricycle recumbents.
Right.
I've seen skateboards. I've seen everything except the pogo stick.
Yeah, probably a good thing.
So it's really a parade of bicycles and a different variety of styles and vehicles.
Well, and one of the things that goes along with these different bicycles are the teams. And that's the last thing I want to talk about, because I really would like to encourage people, if they want to know more about Ragbri, the book is just amazing. It really does cover soup to nuts on, you know, America's favorite bicycle ride. So I can remember when we went that there were teams. I mean, you could, like, line up behind somebody and you could hear Mozart in the morning, for example. Or, or you could watch somebody prepare right from the back of his bike margaritas. It was hilarious. So tell us about the teams a little bit.
Just like the bikes, there's a huge variety of teams. And they run the whole gamut from bad boy partiers to serious, dedicated folks riding to raise money to fight some disease or illness. So you've got Team Live Strong, which is raising money, of course, to help cancer survivors. And then you have, another team that's just there to party. But that's another good thing about the ride, is you can choose. Where do you fit into this mix? The ride can be whatever you want it to be. There's a Team Gourmet, a team that prepares gourmet foods all along the way, sit-down dinners each night, and they bring their own chefs and freezer full of truffles and other gourmet goodies.
Ooh, I want to go with them.
Really, really. And then you have people that are going to almost race. They get up early and they bike and they're done by noon. And
right.
They just go to the swimming pool. And they're riding really light, expensive bikes. So, you know, you just fit in anywhere you're most suited.
Well, I can say that if you really want to know about RAGBRAI and all of these aspects of it, this book, the author is Greg Borzo. It's RAGBRAI, America's Favorite Bicycle Ride. The ride begins a week from today, Saturday, and it goes for 7 days. It goes from the Missouri to the Mississippi River. And Greg Borzo, thank you so much for joining me on the show this week. It's exciting to know that RAGBRAI is going strong after 40 years.
Well, long live RAGBRAI.
Yeah, you got it. Have a great day.
Thanks much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Greg Borzo joined me from his home in Chicago, Illinois. He's a journalist who wrote this fabulous book about RAGBRAI, and it really is interesting. Lots of photographs. They do have charts. They talk about the different years, so you can kind of go to whichever chapter interests you. I went to, obviously, the 1999 chapter instantly. It's going to start next Saturday, and good luck to the RAGBRAI riders for 2013. My next guest is Scott Bricker. Scott is the executive director of America Walks, and we're going to find out what walking and bicycling might have in common as advocacy goes forward. Hi, Scott. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I appreciate you joining me this afternoon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. We talk about sustainable communities, sustainable cities on the show all of the time, and walking along with biking is a huge part of sustainability. Can you tell us a little bit about America Walks and your role with the organization?
Absolutely. America Walks is a national nonprofit organization, and we are a 501c3 organization founded in the mid-90s. We are now working nationally to make America a great place to walk with over 500 organizational partners and many, many individual partners as well and individual donors, members. My role in the organization is executive director, and I've been with the organization since March 2010.
Okay, and you actually have a lot of bicycle-related work in your background. How do you see a connection between biking and walking and as we move transportation initiatives forward?
My work is mostly around bicycle, pedestrian, and politics, the intersection of those things. I worked for 11 years at Oregon's Bicycle Transportation Alliance in different roles as education director, political director, executive director. And it's a great segue for me to now be working nationally on issues of walking. Walking and cycling are similar and different. We're very complementary and in many ways, as a transportation mode, quite different. So first of all, I think that they are just sort of slightly different in that walking is a human experience and bicycling is a wonderful technology. And it actually plays out that way as well when you look at the legal system and how we look at what a pedestrian is versus a cyclist. A cyclist is a vehicle on the roadway, at least when you're talking about transportation standpoint. And a pedestrian is what you are when you're not a cyclist or a motor vehicle driver. So it's any time that you're not in a vehicle or in that condition, you are a pedestrian. It doesn't matter if you're in a wheelchair or walking. They're fundamentally seen differently in the law. As well, a cyclist is generally for transportation is interacting within the traffic, within the lanes of traffic, and a pedestrian or someone who's walking is separated on the sidewalk or in a place that's not in the middle of traffic. At least that's the ideal standpoint. There are some places where there are no sidewalks and you have to walk in the roadway. And there are many places, of course, where we work really, really well together. I'm happy to talk about those too.
One of the things I noticed when I was doing some research for our conversation today is that you adopted a sort of a slate of resolutions, and one is about separating bicycles and pedestrian facilities. And I know there's a lot of talk about making sustainable cities accessible, and we want to separate bicycles from traffic, and now we want to separate pedestrians from bicycles. Explain what you mean by that.
Right. Well, the policies that were passed were a little before my time.
Oh, okay.
The points are still there and really well taken. So the best and ideal design for even a multi-use path, which is tends to be bicycles and people walking together, would have some kind of separation. You see that in places like Vancouver, BC, and where they have in their really well-designed multi-use path system that goes all throughout their downtown, they have separated people walking from people cycling because of the speed differential. And even in places where we work really well together, because of that differential, it would be ideal to separate. Cyclists and walkers have very similar desires. We don't want to be around automobile traffic. We want to have pleasant environments. We need to have continuous facilities. So there are a lot of similarities, but even in the systems that are being designed that are really the world-class cycling systems, they still separate cyclists and pedestrians. So if you go to Europe or some of the new things in New York or even some of the low-traffic routes that we have in Portland that are really awesome, they still have separation there. So the cyclists would have their cycle track or their bike boulevard or whatever, they might have a bike lane. The walker and pedestrian would have a sidewalk. The places where mixing and the mixing zones, I think there are lots of places where those work. What's really critical is that the speeds are kept very low and that there's enough room for both the cyclist and the pedestrian.
Right. My guest is Scott Bricker. He's with America Walks. He's out in Portland, Oregon, of course, the mecca for cycling in a lot of ways, but evidently the mecca for walking, too. So one of the things I also noticed about your website and your partners are organizations who partner with you like the CDC and Kaiser Permanente. And we talk a lot about cycling and health. And obviously, walking is intimately related to health, too. So how do you end up partnering with these kind of organizations? And what do they do for you? What do you do for them?
Right. Well, the health community, public health, and now even the private health and the health providers have recognized the importance of physical activity and health, and just keeping healthcare costs contained. And the best way to do that is through daily physical activity through community design. Walking is the most accessible form of physical activity. Literally, get up off the couch, walk out your door. So, and also when you look at health disparities, which is a big area for the health providers and public health professionals, that for the folks that have the kind of the worst health or the most likely to have diseases that are chronic diseases and expensive diseases, that walking is a perfect intervention for them. And so there's a recognition of the benefits as well. And George Halverson from Kaiser Permanente in his online video was like 6 minutes of incredible statistics. He basically says that humans are designed to walk, that our bodies work best when we walk. And so I do think that the public health community is really recognizing that. And so they're starting to invest in specifically in walking, as well as in the built environment to facilitate active transportation, bicycling and walking, and as well as recreation, access to parks and whatnot. So they're great partners. And one of the things we're also doing with Kaiser upcoming is the 2013 Walking Summit, which will be in Washington, D.C. from October 1st through 3rd. So I really encourage people to attend that. The Centers for Disease Control, we're doing a bunch of work with them, including some community outreach projects where we're trying to provide technical resources to communities to improve walking and walkability. And then right now the U.S. Surgeon General has also gotten on board with walking and walkability and has a proposed call to action, which is their highest level document to get the nation walking.
Wow. So you've got some big partners helping you move your agenda forward. I think that's awesome. So one of the things that we always talk about is the cost of getting infrastructure changed. And when we talk about the nitty-gritty of walking, what are some of the things that big cities like And Cleveland, while it isn't huge anymore, still is sort of a congested downtown area. And then you have downtown Portland. What are some of the less expensive things that say, an organization like America Walks could go to the mayor and say, this is what we need to do so that more people are willing to walk?
Right. Well, from the built environment side, I do agree that many of the infrastructure improvements cost money. However, from a bang for the buck standpoint, we do argue pretty heavily that these infrastructure improvements are very modest in their cost compared to large freeway projects and interchange projects that can cost $50 million in interchange and billions of dollars for new bridges and roadway widening. With that said, I do think that there are low-cost solutions that communities can look at as a way to spur the imagination and support in places that may not have that understanding and support. And there's great programs like the Better Blocks program and other kinds of programs that look at repurposing streets. Project for Public Spaces has a lot of great things that they work on. And basically looking at taking existing space and trying to repurpose that in a really low-cost way to be more accommodating and attractive to people. And when you try and create a space that actually attracts people as opposed to cars, then you do bring more people in. And we like to say, especially to the business folks and to the mayors, is what we're really trying to do is get the pocketbooks and wallets as close to the cash registers as possible. So even basic things like street fairs, where you close the street for a day, and the whole Sunday Parkway Ciclovia program where you close streets for periods of time, and people will flock out to those. And those are days where the business districts do quite well, where lots of foot traffic, it comes through those areas, and they get a lot of recognition. So there are things that like that where you need to build some kind of awareness and understanding that if we create more walkable spaces and people want to be attracted to those, that it will actually increase property values, increase business sales. And we've seen that all over the country. I mean, New York and their Times Square experiment has shown incredible benefits for the businesses. And there are many other places that have done that. The other thing is that many downtowns have extra right-of-way. We were just doing a workshop in Omaha where they have these massive 3- and 4-lane roads, and there's just so much opportunity to be able to just take a little bit of that and repurpose it. So you don't have to even create and build anything new. You can just kind of re-envision, how can we create some sidewalk cafes here? How can we kind of expand the area for the people and the businesses, and perhaps just reduce some of the capacity for the automobile?
Well, the last thing I want to talk about is getting people involved with America Walks, because we do talk about people coming from the grassroots and helping these organizations all over the country and making their own personal communities better. And I know that when we even talk with people like Ray LaHood, who just stepped down as Secretary of Transportation, he says, get involved locally. So how can people get involved with America Walks?
Right. Well, there are a number of ways you can get involved with America Walks. The first thing to do is to go onto our website and endorse the vision for Walkable America, and that will also get you on our email list, which will tell you when we have different resources available. And we'd love to have you in that network. We provide webinars and a variety of technical services online. Our walksteps.org website is actually our technical service website. And we had the first stop shopping for walking strategies you can do in your community. And again, our webinars and discussion forums will provide you with different both technical and strategy ideas. America Walks also does workshops around the country where we work with communities to help them develop walking groups and walking campaigns. And so you could contact America Walks, you can contact me, to request one of those workshops. And we have, we just completed a round of 10 workshops in the first half of the year, and we're in the process of setting up our next workshops. And so we look to go to communities to provide that technical service so you can start your own group, or many times it's working within a coalition structure to have a walking-focused project. And then you can get involved with some of our national things, like our 2013 Walking Summit. We're hoping to attract people from around the country who are advocates, professionals in a variety of different sectors to come and learn to be part of the movement and ultimately to participate in the Walk the Hill Day, the first Hill Day for walking that will take place on October 3rd.
Yes, we know about getting up to the hill and stating our case. Well, Scott, I really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to talk to me about America Walks. I know listeners walk as well as ride, so I hope you have a lot of luck with your big summit this fall, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good afternoon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Scott Bricker joined me from his offices in Portland, Oregon. As we said, Scott is the director of America Walks. I'm going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to talk with Lindsay Voorhees on The Outspoken Cyclist.
On the weekend of July 13th and 14th, the U.S. Aviation Museum proudly presents A Gathering of Eagles 17, an air show event featuring World War II vintage aircraft and reenactors at Lost Nation Airport in Willoughby. Among the many groups present will be members of the Disabled American Veterans Flight Team manning a restored B-25 Mitchell aircraft as DAV brings its message of support for veterans to Northeast Ohio. Admission and more information on A Gathering of Eagles on the web at usam.us.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. We're going to head over to Bend, Oregon, where I'm going to speak with Lindsay Voorhees, a survivor. Lindsay, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So I want to begin our conversation with the fun fact that you sent to me and what the impact was that it had on your life. Tell me about your television debut as a survivor in 2001.
Well, that was interesting. I was in advertising, and it was kind of during that time where the dot-coms were flourishing, and those were all of our clients. And then the dot-com boom had a crash, and they laid off our department. And I don't know, my friend handed me the application and said, you should try this. It's some reality show for athletes, and I didn't really know much about it. And I went and watched an episode and thought it was kind of cheesy, but I applied anyway and ended up vying for $1 million in the middle of Kenya, Africa.
Oh, my gosh. So I don't know much about the show. I know it's been on a long time. Obviously, if this was 2001, this is like 12 years ago. So they picked you because you were an athlete, and I take it most of the contestants are athletic?
No. You have to do some form of crazy.
Ah, I see. Oh, well, that includes almost all of us.
Yeah. They're very strategic about how they pick people. We went through 8 days of interviews sequestered to hotel rooms, and they pick people who are naturally pretty type A personalities within their social groups, but that they know will most likely conflict with each other.
Isn't that interesting?
It's really interesting. I call it the bad human experiment because they strip you of all your comforts, and then your emotions and moods are exacerbated by thirst and hunger and discomfort. So it's definitely kind of a bad human experiment. But, I like to say it was one of the best and the worst experiences of my life. It changed me a lot. It was devastating to watch myself on TV, and I didn't love really who I was or who I came across as, and it kind of rolled into me finding myself again through my bike and finding confidence in everything that I do. So it was an interesting time in my life.
Wow. And that was actually, when you think about it, that was a long time ago now, 12 years. So you did go back, and the bicycle became sort of your salvation.
It did. It just kind of that whole TV experience. We went on talk shows like Howard Stern and David Letterman, and I was in an Eminem music video and went to, red carpet events and charity events with big name celebrities, and then suddenly it's just over. They use you, and then when the next cast comes around, they're done with you. And
wow.
Not only was that sort of shocking, but just the whole kind of rehashing what I didn't like about myself on the show. And so I got pretty low for a little while, just lost my self-esteem, kind of didn't know where I fit in this world. And I met my husband, who's a pro mountain biker, and he just brought me into this, you know, what I like to call a passionate lifestyle, where I live for things I'm passionate about, and I work hard to share my passion with others. And it just sort of helped me grow up and see outside myself instead of kind of dwell on behavior from TV or what have you. I also met a man who he grew up with. His father died of cocaine when he was 5 years old, and his mom turned to drugs to try to stay awake to raise her only son. And he grew up amongst a lot of meth addicts and had some really rough times growing up, but then became one of the best mountain bikers in the world. So he has really been an integral role in showing me that you can be married to your story or feel bad about yourself from what happened in the past, or you can take control of yourself now.
Well, you certainly have started giving back to the women's cycling community in a huge way. And that's really what I want to talk about. And I'm really glad that you found on the other side of this sort of bizarre experience who you are, because who you are is pretty cool today. So what you do is you run skills clinics, mountain bike skill clinics for women. Now, I'm older. I'm in my 60s, and I don't know if I would ever get back on a mountain bike and do crazy things. But tell me about the skills that you teach these women and what these women then get out of it. And I'm sure it's a lot.
Well, that's just it. You said you don't want to get back on a mountain bike and do these crazy things. Well, and I think that's the common misperception with mountain biking. It doesn't have to be crazy. It is a challenging sport, but it depends on the trails you choose to ride on. You know, it's almost like I find a lot of symmetry between mountain biking and life. You know, you choose your path, and if that path feels too hard or too challenging, then choose an easier path and succeed at it before you move on to the more difficult path in life or on a bike. And, you know, I found a need in the industry for more women to feel comfortable on bikes. And I think that a lot of women were just intimidated because they have that in their head that it's a scary, gnarly activity where they're going to get hurt. And so I found that more and more couples are wanting to get into this sport together. I see a lot of women whose men or partners love it and they don't understand it. And so I really just wanted to put myself out there to show women, this is what it's all about. This is what your husbands or boyfriends or partners or whomever are enjoying so much. It's this sense of freedom, this exercise and peace of mind that doesn't feel like exercise. It's being outside, being one with nature, and learning a sport that takes a lot of time and takes a lot of patience. And it teaches you to believe in yourself and trust in yourself and trust in the process. And I think that's what I love to pass along most, is that you're not going to master this sport in one day. You need to take your time and grow gradually. And I know for me personally, it slowed me down. It forced me to take my time and be in the moment and not let all of the noise in my head get in my way, and to stop having self-sabotaging thoughts in life and on the bike. Because the minute you don't believe you can ride through that rock garden, you won't be able to ride through that rock garden. And I feel like I give women the tools to take it slow and enjoy the process of learning a mountain bike. And I truly believe it translates into other aspects of their life.
When you do one of these clinics, how long does it last? Is it like a couple of days or a few hours, or how does it? Take me through one of your clinics.
Well, it depends. I do a lot of private clinics here in Bend when I'm home. I'm usually only home during the week. And the private clinics, where it's just one-on-one or a small group of six, I go for about 4 hours. And we go through a lot of fundamentals and do a little bit of trail time. But it's really just to get them feeling really comfortable about moving their bikes around. And what I try to teach is how to build a relationship with your bike. Your bike can't do anything without you. And a lot of people just sit there and expect their bikes to do everything, get over those rocks or go around that corner. I teach them how to have a relationship with their bike and how to give it what it needs and how to figure out what it needs so they can provide that for their bike. Other clinics that I do around the country, like the one I'm headed to in West Virginia, that's a downhill clinic, and that's at a mountain. And the mountain resort puts it on, and we wear big full-face helmets, and we downhill down the mountain and come back up on a chairlift. And that's a two-day clinic. So the women all come. We do two full days of skills and riding. They spend the night. We have dinner together. It's a more, like, all-inclusive clinic. So they kind of vary, you know, depending on what people want. But when I travel, it's usually to go to these big 40 women or more clinics where there are a couple of days and people come in from out of town and they stay the night and they progress together in a big group. And it's just, not only is it empowering for each of them to work on their skills and improve as riders, but there's a lot of bonding going on, you know, even though we're doing kind of a gnarly sport and we're all learning this kind of, you know, riding our bikes on dirt, we're still women who like to attach ourselves to other women. And I've really found at these clinics and with all the coaches I deal with, honestly, for the first time in my life, I see all these wonderful type A personalities getting along seamlessly because we're doing something we all love. We're doing something we're passionate about, and we're doing something that can be physically and emotionally intimidating, and all we want for each other is to succeed at it. And that's, I feel like, kind of rare in the world of women. Women tend to be competitive or insecure or have all these emotions that get in their way from building solid relationships with other women sometimes. And I really find in the bike industry or in the mountain bike world, women are just open and loving, and they just want someone else to share this with. And if they can encourage a girl to get over that log in the trail and she accomplishes it, it's crazy how excited everyone gets and how it just becomes this like team building exercise. It's just awesome.
It sounds like it. I'm thinking, well, you know, like I fit your profile right to the T. So yep. I'm like, maybe I'll think about this. Meanwhile, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lindsay Voorhees. She's in Bend, Oregon, getting ready to go to West Virginia to teach a mountain bike skills clinic. Tell me about the age range of the women who usually show up at one of these big clinics like you're doing at this mountain resort.
You know, it's really funny. They come in all ages. I can't even emphasize enough the age span. I mean, I'll just give an example from last weekend up in Seattle. This was more of a free ride clinic, meaning focused on jumping, getting the wheels off the ground, focused on, you know, higher level stuff. Yeah, and I don't specialize in that. I specialize in, you know, beginners to advanced cross-country riders, people who want to learn to handle their bikes better on the downhills or what have you. But the jumping thing, I'm still fairly new to, and I was shocked. There were 12-year-olds jumping better than I could ever imagine myself jumping at almost 40 years old. And there were 50-something-year-olds wanting to jump. And they looked at the registration, and 90% of our entrants were 35 years and older. And there were 48 women there.
Wow. That's a huge group.
It was huge. I mean, I had 90 women in Keystone, Colorado, 2 weeks ago. And again, that was 20 years old to 50s. And it's funny because what I'm finding with mountain biking, and I believe this to be true with myself, I feel like it's a mature sport because it requires you to pay attention, get out of your head, stay in the moment, and be patient with yourself. I believe it requires a little bit more maturity to understand this sport on a deeper level. And I think we're passing it down to generations because the younger generation is learning the importance of being passionate about something and being active. And so I think it's rubbing off on the younger generation. But I do believe, you know, my generation, the 30-somethings, we're just finding ourselves and we're just finding our peace in life and having this sport that encourages growth and encourages self-awareness and body awareness. It's just a really good thing for women in their 30s who are just getting to that point where they're like, okay, I'm getting comfortable with myself now. Now what's next, you know?
Sure.
Mountain biking.
Why not? Why not?
Why not?
Talk to me about the equipment, the bike itself, and then obviously the safety equipment. Everybody realizes you need a helmet, you need gloves, you need long pants, or whatever it is you're using if you're doing jumping or going through the woods and that kind of thing. Talk to me about the bike a little bit, though. Do you actually do fittings with the people so you know they have a bike that is suitable? Are you using suspension bikes or non-suspension? What's going on with the bikes? I assume they arrive with their own bikes.
Yeah, most of the time they'll arrive with their own bikes. Some of the clinics, again, they all vary. Some of the clinics, demo tours will come. Like in Indiana a couple weeks ago, the giant women's bicycle tour and a Trek women's bicycle demo tour were there with 20 demo bikes on hand for all the ladies.
Nice.
Yeah, and they're mostly full suspension bikes, 26 or 29-inch wheels. And, of course, it depends on the type of mountain biking, because Lord knows there's like 10 bikes for every different type of riding these days. But
right.
For the most part, they come on their own bikes, and some have hardtail, some have full suspension, some have very little suspension, some have a lot of suspension, old bikes, new bikes, you name it. They run the gamut. And that's the first thing we do, is we go around and we do a bike check with the women, and we make sure they understand just how to feel, make sure the skewers are tight and everything's working properly, and making sure they can reach their brake levers and that they understand how to shift and that the bike is suited for their body type. It's not too long for their reach. It's not too short. The seat height is good. So we definitely go through all the bikes. And, you know, yes, good equipment makes things better, just like, you know, technology and skis keep improving. But you always have those old school people who are like, well, I don't need any of that fancy stuff. My old skis work just fine. You get that too. You know, you get women on old bikes with real skinny handlebars, which are a little harder to control, and you just work with it. If they want to keep their old equipment, then you make them feel comfortable on the bike they have. And so with that said, then you've got the whole pedal issue. Do you clip into clips or do you have flat pedals? Then there's the shoes. You need to get shoes with clips, or you need to get good flat shoes that stick to your pedals. And of course, gloves are always good, because if you do go down, you want your hands protected. And if your hands are sweaty, you know, the gloves keep them on the grips, and then the helmet. And again, it's different kind of cycling. If you're doing mostly pedaling with some downhilling in the trail, then yeah, your regular ventilated cross-country helmet is a good helmet to have. And then if you're doing strictly downhilling on bigger bikes on a mountain with chairlifts, I wear a full-face helmet just because I'm going a bit faster, the bike is bigger, I'm probably jumping a little bit more, and, you know, I just want to protect my face. So there is a bit of equipment involved in mountain biking for sure, and it can definitely get expensive. But hopefully, you know, when people, they invest in it, they have it for a long time, and it lasts a long time. And, you know, what it does for your life and your soul, I think, far outweighs the price of getting into it. So, you know, it's one of those things, though, you feel guilty when you're like, oh, yeah, try my bike. It's like out there. Isn't that sweet? Doesn't it feel so good? And you're like, oh, it retails for $8,000.
Right, exactly.
Sorry, it's more expensive than my BMW.
Right. Well, and I do know about that. Because that's been my business all these years. I owned a custom bike shop. So tell me what PMBI and the ZEP techniques are.
Well, once I decided to really pursue teaching women, I'd always kind of given pointers as I was learning from other women. I would start passing on those pointers to other women, because I really realized, at least the men in my life, I have one of the best mountain bikers in the world as a husband, and I can't learn from him. And it's not that he doesn't explain it well, which I have to argue maybe he doesn't, but I just, there's a block that I had not wanting to listen to him. And so I started realizing, man, I should really learn to teach, because I feel like women are more in depth. We want details. We want specifics. And so I looked into getting certified to teach, and there were only two programs out there or that I knew about. And I took both of them. So the first one was the PMBI, Professional Mountain Bike Instructor Certification course. And his name is Paul, and he calls his technique the ZEP techniques. And I think it's just a funny name because he used to be called Captain Zepp as a kid.
I see.
But anyway, he's a really great guy from England, and he was a certified snowboard instructor his whole life, and he saw kind of a void in the bike industry for a structured way of teaching where everyone was using the same language and teaching things similarly so everyone really understood it and could pass it on. And so I took that and his course up in Whistler, and that was really exciting because Whistler is kind of the hub for mountain biking. It's the place you want to go if you really want to step up your mountain biking. So it's more technical up there. It's a lot steeper. So it was really exciting to get my teaching certificate up there on some, you know, pretty technical terrain. And then after that, I took what is called the IMIC, which is the International Mountain Bike Instructor Certification course. And since then, IMBA, the International Mountain Bike Association, bought that course. And so I got certified through them, but now I'm recognized as a certified instructor by IMBA. And IMBA is going to be training me to be able to teach people how to teach.
Uh-huh.
So I will also be able to certify people to teach. And it's just growing because more and more people want to help others get into mountain biking. And if you learn the process that really works as far as progressions go, because A, everyone learns at a different speed. But if you start, even the advanced people who say, I've been riding 20 years, I promise you, they will be blown away at what they don't know or what they never learned about how to ride a bike. And so these certification classes and being able to teach others how to teach, just make sure everyone's learning the proper progressions at the proper time. They're all speaking the same language, and it's making it just a safer, better way for people to get into mountain biking. So I'm really excited about these certification courses. And you don't have to be certified to teach someone, you know, how to mountain bike. But as these resorts and more clubs are putting on clinics, like, for instance, I'm going to Copper Harbor, Michigan, right after West Virginia. And that happened because a friend of mine moved there. She got involved in the Women's Cycling Club. The Women's Cycling Club heard from her about how, you know, her friend Lindsay is an instructor. Wouldn't it be fun to get her out here? So they all banded together and said, well, we have 40 women interested in taking the clinic from you. What is it going to take for us to get you out here?
Wow.
And that's how it happened. This mountain bike women's group, you know, came together. They raised some money. They got some sponsors, and they're flying me out. And I'm hosting a clinic for 40-some women in Copper Harbor, Michigan, where I've never been before.
Wow.
And it's just great because it's showing people that it just starts with one person saying, I want to bring a world-class coach in to teach us how to ride, and they make it happen. And it's becoming this community of women saying, man, we need a clinic in Virginia. We need a clinic in New York. And it's spreading like wildfire. It's crazy. The more women who start talking about how much they've learned from taking a clinic, I think the more groups and mountain resorts are interested in, if you build it, they will come. Just throw the clinic and get them out here.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I'm starting to focus on women cycling in a kind of different way. And in fact, you're the very first guest that I have in a series that's going to be kind of ongoing on the show about women in cycling at this level, this professional level, this level of raising women up in the sport. So regardless of whether it's road, track, mountain, whatever, even commuter and transportation, getting more women on bikes. So what do you think holds most women back from being engaged in cycling?
Fear. I mean, I really think fear is a word I hear a lot from people. Insecurities, not having a group to go with, feeling insecure about putting themselves out there looking for a group to go with. It is an individual sport for the most part. You know, I try to teach people, if you're going with people who ride faster than you or are more experienced with you than you, I think that's a big hesitation for people is, well, everyone who rides, they know how to ride and they're faster than me and I just hold them up. And, you know, I like to teach them to look at it differently. Like, look at it as you're putting yourself out there into a new sport, and yes, it's intimidating and yes, it's scary, but that is mountain biking. it is intimidating and it is scary, and so are a lot of other things in life. So learn how to conquer these fears and take that first step into, you know, go into a shop and say, I'm really nervous. I want to learn how to bike, and I don't have anyone to go with, and that my friends who do ride are really fast, and I'd like to find people at my level. And hopefully most shops will say, well, there's a women's group in town. You should meet them. And if there is a women's group in town, then I hope that's their mission, to get you out on a ride and make you feel comfortable and ease you into it. But I definitely think, you know, cost can probably play a role, because I know a lot of wonderful women who would love to mountain bike, and they don't have $800 to spend. And, you know, $800 is barely going to touch the surface of what you need to really be able to mountain bike.
And, I know. Yeah.
You know, I think cost plays its role. But then again, find someone with an old bike that they're willing to let you try it out on, or demo a few bikes from a shop and see how you feel. But I think, again, it's that fear and that intimidation factor that women need to just break through, and in all areas of life. I was just listening to an interview with the new COO of Facebook, and she wrote a book called Lean In, and it's all about women being more powerful and more outspoken
right.
in the workplace. And I feel that way about these sports that tend to be male-dominated. I mean, the bike industry as a whole is extremely male-dominated. You can barely find any women who work in these bike companies.
No kidding.
It's ridiculous. You
it
know?
Is
and
ridiculous.
All these companies are trying to do women's lines of products, and they have women's marketing departments, and they're definitely growing. But it's an uphill battle, like it always has been. But you know what? When you get on that uphill and it starts to hurt and you want to give up, you just keep pedaling. And I think that's what's going to keep happening. People are just going to keep pedaling and finding their place, and pretty soon it's going to be run by women.
You know, it's very funny you say that, because I think you are right. We've been talking about, why can't we take over the UCI, for example? Well, you know what? I could spend all day talking to you. This has been really, really fun. I think you have some wonderful things to say. I'm very interested in what you're doing. I think it's awesome what you're doing. And I am thrilled to have been able to talk with you. So I want you to have a really nice trip. Enjoy West Virginia. It's beautiful there. And what are you flying from there up to Michigan?
Yep, I go from West Virginia into Copper Harbor.
You're going to fly right over Cleveland, so you can wave on your way.
I'll drop my bike juju on you.
Oh, there you go. Good idea. Well, perhaps we'll meet at some event someday soon. I wish you a lot of luck, and keep doing what you're doing. It's pretty awesome.
Well, thank you. Thanks All for right. reaching out. I appreciate it. And please keep in touch.
I will.
Be involved wherever I can.
Thank you, Lindsay. Have a great afternoon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lindsay Voorhees joined me from her home in Bend, Oregon, and she's rushing for a plane to go to West Virginia to teach some mountain bike skills clinics to evidently tons of women. What an interesting girl. I really enjoyed learning about her. So that's our show for the week. It was chock full. I hope you're still watching the tour. I hope you're taking a ride. And if you're going on Ragbri, have a good time. We'll see you next week on The Outspoken Cyclist. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.